Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how do you campaign for an initiative as opposed to a candidate?
And how a large extended family is helping in the fight against Alzheimer's disease.
But first, the state's universal school voucher program is under the microscope this week, and it's getting attacked from both sides. First, the Grand Canyon Institute came out with a headline-making report that families who get the Empowerment Scholarship Accounts, or ESAs, haven't spent a whole lot of that money, and they're sitting on some $360 million in accumulated state money. Then the Goldwater Institute came forward with a lawsuit from two homeschooling Arizona moms who say they can no longer use ESA funds to pay for things like pencils, erasers, or some books. They blame Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays for adding curriculum requirements earlier this summer. It's all raising questions from all sides about the controversial program, which now serves more than 78,000 Arizona students at a cost of about $718 million last school year. And here to explain it all is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with this Grand Canyon Institute report. They are a nonpartisan think tank, I should say, but this created quite a stir. $360 million that's been given out to families to spend on education that's just kind of sitting. And it's because these funds roll over year to year?
Yes. And so, yeah, Grand Canyon, they are self-labeled nonpartisan. I will say that they're pretty critical of the ESA program generally. And so they typically do reports like this, looking at what they see as flaws with the program. Yeah, when a parent, they get an a median amount of about $7,400 a year with these vouchers. If they don't spend all of that on private school tuition or homeschooling supplies, that kind of thing, it just sits in their account and they can either use it the next year or eventually, if their child graduates, they can actually use that towards university tuition.
University. Okay. So have we ever, how does this compare, I guess, to how much is being spent in the program? Like we mentioned $718 million. This is a good chunk of that.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, $718 million for the year, that's expected to continue kind of ticking up as enrollment goes up in the program. And so it's, yeah, it's roughly half of the annual budget for the program since it was universally expanded to all students in the state.
Okay, so Wayne, put this into context for us. This comes as we've seen report after report over the last year or so kind of saying just how much this program's costing. There have been lots of debates about this at the state capitol, lots of concerns about the cost of the program. At the same time, we have a budget deficit. Talk about how this kind of plays into that larger narrative.
Yeah, so until lawmakers and the governor made some fairly steep budget cuts across the board over the summer, we were facing a $1.2, $1.4 billion budget deficit over the next 2 years. Now, voucher critics blame the voucher program for that because, as you mentioned, hundreds of millions of dollars are going into that program, including to many students who weren't in the public school system before, so they view that as added costs. Mm-hmm. Now, proponents of the program say it's a more efficient use of those dollars, and so without getting into the minutia of that, it's a huge part of that budget discussion and where our state tax dollars are going. Now, I will say that proponents of the program also say that a lot of this money left over is more for students with special needs who get a higher award and maybe have those expenses spread out more over the year. So mm-hmm. they may not have used it now, but if it rolls over to next year, it'll eventually get spent. That being said, with $360 million in the bank, that shows that a lot of that money is just kind of sitting there gathering dust.
Mm. Okay, so then let's talk about this other story, this lawsuit by these two moms. What's their complaint?
So they're basically saying that their expenses aren't getting approved. When you have these school vouchers, you get these various school-related expenses. You submit it to the Department of Education for approval to get reimbursed with that voucher money. But earlier this year, Attorney General Chris Mays' office contended that some of the rules that were adopted by the State Board of Education actually violated the law because they didn't require that curriculum component to say, hey, I'm buying this because here's where it fits into a curriculum that my student is using. Mm-hmm. The rule book doesn't say that, but the state law appears to say that. And so Mays kind of notified the Department of Education that I'm looking into this. The Department of Education agreed to use that moving forward.
Right, right. And we should say the Department of Education, the Republican superintendent, Tom Horn, didn't you know, fight those changes. He let them go through.
Yeah, I mean, he put out a statement at one point saying, you know, he ran what Mays's office was saying by some of the higher level folks in his office and said, don't treat this as a partisan, just look at this as a legal argument and what do you think? And he basically said at the time that my staff kind of said, yeah, this is a sound legal reading of the law.
Okay. And this kind of came as there were headlines about things that were, you know, being bought with these ESA funds that seemed pretty far outside of the school realm.
Yeah, the big ones that get pointed to, I think there were some snowball ski passes in there. There were some driving lessons at a place that uses like luxury vehicles for that kind of thing. I think maybe some grand pianos or things of that nature. So it's some things that maybe you could make an argument have an education purpose, but maybe we're on the higher end of those expenses, not something a public school student, for instance, would expect to be covered in their classroom.
That's for sure. Okay, so Republicans in the state legislature expanded this ESA program, and they have been very resistant to just about any kind of reform measures that Democrats have really tried to push for a long time here. We are, of course, in the midst of a campaign season, Wayne. I'm guessing this is an issue.
Yeah, especially for Democrats who are, you know, have made rolling back this universal expansion that let all students enter this program a few years ago. They said, you know, this is draining public education funds. We want to roll it all the way back. Now, that message has been tempered in recent years to maybe not roll it all the way back, but put a lot of guardrails in there to make sure the money's being spent the correct way, make sure the right safety measures are there to make sure the folks that are teaching kids under these programs are held to the same standards as teachers in public school, that kind of thing. I did speak to a pollster who told me basically there's broad bipartisan support amongst the electorate for those regulation increases, but maybe not for rolling back the program entirely.
Okay, so if Democrats do what they say they will do here, which is take, you know, at least one chamber of the state legislature this time around, this could be a very different story, right? There's a lot at stake here in terms of the ESA program.
I think if we're going to see major changes, the Democrats would have to take both chambers because the Republicans, as you said, have been just super resistant. This was a key issue for Governor Doug Ducey, the Republican, back when he signed it, and for a lot of Republican lawmakers. They believe school choice is the way. They believe parents should be able to take this money and educate their kids how they see fit. And so I really don't see substantial changes to this program coming unless Democrats kind of control both chambers and the governor's office.
All right. We will leave it there. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Roughly 7 million Americans age 65 and older have Alzheimer's disease, according to the National Institutes of Health. And there's lots of research into ways to treat it. But scientists are also working on ways to try to prevent people from developing Alzheimer's in the first place. And that's the kind of research our next guest is involved with. Dr. Eric Ryman is executive director of Banner Alzheimer's Institute and CEO of Banner Research. He and some colleagues have been working with a large extended family in Colombia, and they've discovered in this family a rare genetic mutation that makes it almost certain that they'll develop early onset Alzheimer's. Ryman came by the studio recently to talk about this discovery, as well as the people who've been suffering with it. And we started with the backstory on who these family members are and why this was such an interesting group for him to study.
Well, we now know of a number of genetic risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, including a common genetic risk factor known as ApoE, which contributes to the more common form of Alzheimer's that occurs at older ages. There's a rare genetic form of Alzheimer's disease in which individuals who carry a gene are destined to develop Alzheimer's disease and become cognitively impaired in their 40s or 50s. And there are about 1,000 of these extended families, all from a common ancestor, in which if they have the gene, they're going to develop cognitive problems, and their children have a 1 in 2 chance of inheriting that same gene. When we first became interested in doing a sufficiently large prevention trial, the world's first prevention trial for Alzheimer's disease, we wondered if we could study individuals who are at high imminent risk for developing symptoms. And we were aware of a remarkable kindred, this extended family, in the vicinity of Medellin, Colombia, that carry one of these genes. And a friend and partner of mine, who we got to know over the years, was Francisco Lopera, who identified this kindred primarily through baptismal records, all from a common ancestor. With our help, we now have 6,000 members of this extended family,
wow,
roughly 1,200 of whom carry a gene that makes them virtually certain to develop Alzheimer's and become cognitively impaired at the average age of 44.
So what kind of research did you try to do? Obviously, if you know people are destined to get Alzheimer's, it seems like that's sort of a good control group to try to test prevention methods.
Well, first, let me mention when I went down to Colombia, this was a life-changing experience for my colleagues and me, meeting these families who have been living with this for centuries. And what a joy it has been to empower them in the fight against Alzheimer's disease so that we could work together as partners to try to find ways that would be helpful to the family, but also helpful to the rest of the world. And these families and other research participants are my heroes. So we had been planning a prevention trial. This was a prevention trial that got announced way back in 2012. But another thing that one can do is, because you know that they develop cognitive impairment at the age of 44, we could characterize the course of biological changes with brain imaging techniques, cerebral spinal fluid measurements, and now blood tests for Alzheimer's disease, and see when they begin in relationship to cognitive impairment. So one of the first studies we did together was characterize the sequence of these biological changes, some of which occur 25 years before the onset of symptoms, to help inform what we would do in terms of prevention trials.
How has that research helped in the fight to try to get a prevention for Alzheimer's, to try to prevent people from developing it in the first place?
Well, we've had a longstanding interest in Arizona of trying to find and support the approval of prevention therapies. We had this out-of-the-box idea to do that at the time. We proposed two prevention trials, one in this group in Colombia and another in of people with that more common genetic risk factor, two copies of that APOE4 gene, which we did in the United States. And at the time, we figured that if we could propose a strategy, get academic and industry stakeholders, including makers of the most promising treatments that we need their drugs to evaluate, regulatory agencies like FDA, supporting this possibility, it would launch a new era in Alzheimer's prevention research. So when our first prevention trial was announced by the director of NIH and Secretary of Human Health Services in 2012, it did launch that era in Alzheimer's prevention research. Other makers of promising treatments knew it was possible, and you started seeing more and more prevention trials, starting with that very first trial in Colombia.
So where are you now in terms of, you know, more than a decade later, trying to have therapies that could prevent people, both those with the gene and those without, from developing Alzheimer's?
So for that very first trial in Colombia, we conducted a study over 5 to 8 years of a treatment that targets a protein known as amyloid. Amyloid is the major component of amyloid plaques in the brain, which is a cardinal feature of the disease itself. And the particular kind of anti-amyloid treatment we studied didn't work, but it helped to inform how we go about these prevention trials. And we, my colleagues at Banner Alzheimer's Institute and I, have had the privilege of co-leading a growing number of prevention trials. Right now, there are ongoing prevention trials, including of the first two demonstrably effective treatments in patients, amyloid plaque clearing antibody therapies. We and others are conducting the first studies of unimpaired individuals, older adults who have blood test evidence of Alzheimer's disease and imaging evidence of Alzheimer's to see if the treatment works. We believe we have a realistic chance, no guarantee, but a realistic chance to help find and support the approval and accessibility of the first secondary prevention therapies in unimpaired people with blood test evidence of the disease to avert the onset of memory and thinking problems within 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
We think we have a chance to find primary prevention therapies, treatments that are used very infrequently, maybe as infrequently as once per year, in older adults at risk before they do not have any biological evidence of Alzheimer's disease, to try to prevent it completely and have a shot at that within 4 to 5 years. Pretty amazing.
You mentioned how going to Colombia was a life-changing experience, and I'm curious about what it was like interacting with members of these extended families who basically knew that they were going to develop Alzheimer's while they were sort of working with you and going through clinical trials and knowing that maybe what they were doing wouldn't necessarily help them, but could help other family members or just help humanity? Like, what was it? What were those conversations like? What was it like working with these individuals?
So for context, the family members in Colombia typically do not want to know their genetic status.
Hmm.
But if they have a parent who's developed Alzheimer's at a young age, they know they have a 50% chance of getting it. So imagine you're a family member and you have parents, uncles, and aunts, about half of family members on average, who develop this disease at a young age. They're having to change their lives to care for their loved one and worried about the impact that will have on not themselves and their children going forward. And that's what they've been living like for years, these heroic members of this family. When I first got down there, a common question I would ask is, what could we do to be helpful to you? The most common response was, more adult diapers, please.
Mm. Wow.
It's been a joy to work with them.
Dr. Eric Ryman is Executive Director of Banner Alzheimer's Institute and CEO of Banner Research. More of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how theater could be used to cover tough topics like the Holocaust.
But first, let's return to my conversation with Dr. Eric Ryman, Executive Director of Banner Alzheimer's Institute and CEO of Banner Research, about his work with a large extended family in Colombia and the genetic mutation he and his colleagues have found within it. There's a theoretical question that is often asked when it comes to diseases like Alzheimer's. If you could know that you'd get a disease later in life, like cancer or Alzheimer's or something else, would you want to know? And if you do, how would it change the way you live your life? But as Ryman and I discussed, this question was not theoretical for the most part for some of these family members.
You know, when we first started doing the study, we were going to study a drug, an experimental drug, in members of the kindred who had one of these mutations. And they didn't want to know their status. So how did we do that? Well, what we did was we designed a study in which if they had a mutation that caused Alzheimer's, they would either get the experimental drug or placebo. And then other members of the family who didn't have the mutation would get placebo. So that way they didn't have to learn their genetic status and still get that information. For other studies of people at risk, either based on whether they have amyloid plaques before the onset of symptoms or a genetic risk factor, we in the field have developed ways to be able to communicate that information to people about their risk in an informed, constructive way. Assess the impact on people to make sure that they're okay in that regard. And we have colleagues who devote a lot of their time to that very important goal. Eventually, we're going to be in a position, sooner than you might think, to be able to assess individuals who are unimpaired. We don't recommend it in the clinical setting now, to assess their risk based on their genetic status, their biological measurements of Alzheimer's disease in an accessible way, like a blood test. And we're going to need to figure out scalable ways to empower them with the information they want to know what to do with it.
But as you referenced, though, I mean, some of these folks down in Colombia, even if they didn't want to necessarily know, if they saw a parent develop Alzheimer's in their mid-40s, you kind of can't avoid that knowledge.
Right, right.
What was it like for them? I mean, especially the ones who maybe didn't want to know what their future held. What was it like for them sort of being faced with it and not only having the knowledge, but also, as you say, caring for their parent and also then thinking about themselves and their kids?
Right. Well, we've been doing this study with our friends in Colombia under the auspices of a program we call the Alzheimer's Prevention Initiative. There's another study that goes on in the United States and other countries called the Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network. And we all have the same opportunity to make a difference and challenge of working with and helping these remarkable families. All I can tell you is it is a privilege to be working with these individuals. In the families we have been studying in Colombia, they and generations before them have been living with it for decades. And there was almost kind of a fatalistic approach to the idea, well, our extended family is cursed, so to speak. they understand biologically why that turns out to be the case. So to be able to offer them for the first time some hope and some empowerment about how they themselves can help lead this fight against the disease has been a remarkable experience.
I want to ask you about Dr. Francisco Lopera, who, as you referenced, was one of the leaders in Colombia of spearheading this research and bringing all these people together. He unfortunately passed away not that long ago from cancer. How would you describe his influence and his impact on the kind of work that you all are doing now?
I remember the first time I invited him up to Arizona. I think it was roughly around 2006 or 2007. I wanted to introduce Francisco to Governor Napolitano and our commitment to finding a prevention therapy, and also to another researcher who's passed away, Dale Schenck, who developed the first immunization therapies targeting amyloid and Alzheimer's disease. And that was the start of our work together. Here was an individual who was passionate about the families. Imagine we would go into a family's home. I remember one home we would go into in which, just due to bad luck, 6 out of the 7 siblings developed Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
And their children are caring for them. And visited a number of these individuals in their home, and his team knew the story of every single family member in extraordinary detail. That's Francisco. His passion, his commitment, the respect he generated from the community. We wanted to set up in Colombia an infrastructure to do a prevention trial, to permit for that first study intravenous therapies, to have the first PET scanners in Colombia. And because of the respect that in which he was held, when we would have those conversations with other members in the community, somehow it happened. Every time we asked to address a new challenge that most people would think would be impossible, he'd think about it, decide whether he could live up to that expectation, and always exceeded that expectation. And he was somebody who enjoyed celebrating that success. And as we are just about to embark on our next prevention trial, it breaks my heart not to be doing that with Francisco. What I can say is, when we and the field find the first effective prevention therapies, that will be part of his legacy and that of his colleagues and those remarkable families.
It sounds like one of his great strengths, among many, was his ability to gain the trust of the individuals with whom he was working. Because it sounds like, you know, not all of the people who participated in the study were at first willing participants. Like, it sounds like he had to do some convincing and some relationship building and some trust building to get them to be okay to partake.
You know, as he showed us, but also we believed, the key to establishing this partnership with your research participants, which we embrace here in Arizona as well, is the idea of communication, transparency, treating them like valued partners. So before we decided to do a prevention trial or chose a drug, we talked to the family members about what kind of treatment they would be comfortable with, how much safety data was needed, how comfortable would they be with a drug that would be administered intravenously or a subcutaneous injection. They knew we were listening to what they said. We would meet regularly, and that was because of Francisco. So on short notice, when we go down to Colombia for the first time and 700 people show up at a meeting, that's a testament to Francisco and his leadership abilities.
All right. That is Dr. Eric Ryman, Executive Director of the Banner Alzheimer's Institute, also CEO of Banner Research. Dr. Ryman, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. There will be a whole lot of propositions on your ballot this November, from referrals from Republican state legislators looking to get around Governor Katie Hobbs' veto stamp to a collection of citizen-led initiatives run by, well, citizens or local or outside interests who are trying to go around the state legislature to get issues on the ballot. On the referral side, for example, is a measure state lawmakers want voters to decide to give local law enforcement immigration authorities. On the initiative side are measures that will do everything from strengthening abortion rights in our state to creating open primaries here. Lawmakers also sent a measure to the ballot that opponents say would make it harder to get those citizen-led initiatives on it. So how did these citizen-led interests get those measures on the ballot? How do you campaign for a cause as opposed to a candidate? Our next guest has a lot of experience in that arena. Democratic consultant Stacey Pearson has been behind the scenes in some of the highest-profile elections of recent times in our states. She's worked for plenty of candidates, most notably running the campaign for Paul Penzone, the man who finally ousted longtime Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio in 2016. But Pearson has been just as influential in another kind of race, one without a face. She runs initiative campaigns, most notably getting marijuana legalized here recreationally in 2020. I sat down with her recently to get a behind-the-scenes look at these campaigns, starting with the candidates. And she told me you're dealing with a lot of ego there.
So much ego. And there's so much you can't control on a candidate's campaign. You can't control if someone likes this guy's face or not. You can't control someone's face.
And that happens, right? Like you're in a lot of focus groups. You hear a lot of negative feedback to just people and things they can't change about themselves. Yeah.
Oh, yes. It's so much negative feedback that we stopped letting candidates watch the focus groups on themselves. Because it is terrible. It's imagine, you know, walking into a room where everyone's talking about you and not being able to walk away. They don't stop talking.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so is this part of why you say you prefer running campaigns for initiatives? And there are a whole lot of initiatives on the ballot this year, which is why we wanted to talk about this. What's the benefit there? What's the difference?
So initiative campaigns are always issue-based. And so you wind up with these really diverse coalitions that support an issue. Legalization, for example, the Prop 207 in 2020 that legalized recreational marijuana.
Right.
That campaign, we had law enforcement support, we had corrections officers support, and we had the ACLU support. So you wind up being able to find these common threads that people just agree that incarceration's not working for minor drug offenses like marijuana. Mm-hmm. And then putting together policy that meets their needs is really fun and really rewarding.
Right. So there's a level, it sounds like, of coalition making.
Exactly.
Bridging the divide. Does that get challenging as well at times?
Oh, of course. Certainly there are folks who did it well somewhere else who really love to share their knowledge. And it's probably the most frustrating thing about my job is when folks tell me, well, in Nebraska in 2016, this worked. Mm. Well, that's cool. That's great. We're not in Nebraska. And an Arizona Republican is very different than a Nebraska Republican or an Ohio Republican. Arizona in particular is libertarian. It's strange. We're a border state. So sometimes those helpful anecdotes are exactly the opposite.
Yeah. So that sounds like it comes in real handy when you're running campaigns, particularly for issues like knowing the voter here very well and who you're after.
Exactly. And we talk a lot about Arizona's LDS population, members of the Mormon Church, Latter-day Saints. And to explain that that population in Arizona, the voting population, is larger than the African-American voting population is something that folks in D.C. or Chicago or Florida can't even fathom. Mm. They just can't wrap their brains around it.
So it's a specific place-based thing in a way.
100%.
Talk about how you approach that. Like, how do you campaign on signs and make the, you know, prop number whatever mean something to people? How do you message it in advertising? Things like that.
So there are some really easy examples, like legalizing marijuana or passing Prop 139, the abortion initiative. Yep. Those require very little explanation. People know what it is. The harder ones are a Flagstaff transportation initiative, for example. I mean, trying to get folks really excited about having more frequent bus service is where we really start to use all the tools in the toolbox.
You have to get creative sometimes.
Exactly.
Is that a big challenge, like just making sure voters understand what the heck something does? I mean, it's not that simple, and these are not policy experts we're talking about.
Oh, that is the most difficult component of the referrals and the initiatives and the props that are at the bottom of the ballot. In Tucson, for example, we were running an initiative to fund the zoo, the Reed Park Zoo. And it was a two-question question.
Okay.
And the first question was on the bottom of the front side of the ballot. And the second question was on the top of the second side of the ballot. Just telling voters to turn over their ballot was so hard. Getting folks, you're not done yet. You're going to see the front, but you got to flip it over.
Oh my
Please
gosh.
Flip it over. It was, and the front side won by a large margin. The back side barely squeaked out. And it was just folks that filled their ballot out, put it in the envelope, and sent it off without finishing the back.
So talk a little bit about the funding of these, right? Like, what's the difference between having a campaign that is locally kind of grassroots based and then locally funded versus a lot of initiatives are initiatives that have been run in other places and then are brought here with outside funding. Is that harder?
Both have their advantages and disadvantages. So when you have someone sending $5 a month because they believe that Sheriff Joe needs to go, that retiree is telling her friends, you know, at the senior center that she's voting for Sheriff Penzone at that time.
A campaign you ran, we should say, yeah.
Yeah, a campaign I ran. And those were my favorite. The folks that would send their checks in the envelopes with little notes, like, keep working hard. I mean, that keeps the day going for lots of folks. On the flip side, the national money understands that Arizona is ground zero for competitive states. Our swing state status means that we have to win some of these big initiatives, be abortion, restoring Roe versus Wade in Arizona. If it was Proposition 207, marijuana legalization again, we really need our top of the ticket candidates to align with progressive values at the bottom two. And so those national funders really help steer that tail that wags the dog. So the initiatives that then help float the top of the ticket.
Are there times in which you know that you're going to run something, it's going to fail, but then the next time you run it, it might win?
Sometimes. I think in the referrals, we see that occasionally. In Arizona, it has gotten so expensive to collect signatures that no one's flying a test balloon anymore. And so even to get prepared to qualify and to hire a signature gathering firm, you're talking tens of millions of dollars, both in legal and in the physical collection of signatures.
Is that just because, Stacey, like you're collecting signatures, right? But we've seen so many challenges on everything an initiative does, from the wording of the initiative to the description of the initiative. It's challenged almost at every turn, it seems like.
It is. And that was a result of very intentional conservative policy that dislikes direct democracy tremendously. So I'll say that again, like we have passed laws in this state, either direct or through referrals, that make it so much more difficult. So for example, we called it the coffee stain standard, but we went from substantial compliance to strict compliance on a signature sheet. So if I, Stacey Pearson, signed my name and then start filling out my address and I transpose the state and the zip code box. When we had substantial compliance, it was very clear that I know what a zip code is and I know what a state is, and I just got it in the wrong holes, right? Strict compliance, you can challenge that line. And so that intentional level of difficulty, increased level of difficulty, is now makes everything so much more expensive. You have to gather so many more signatures knowing that some like that are going to be kicked off.
I mean, so, and part of this will play into the next answer here, which is that citizen initiatives, if they pass, are very hard to undo, right? If some of these initiatives pass that are on the ballot this time around, that will make it even more difficult for a citizen initiative to get on the ballot in the end. You're coming at this from the Democratic side of the aisle, obviously.
Right.
Like, is there a risk that one day the Democrats will be in charge and you're going to see a lot of citizen initiatives from the right that may very well pass?
Of course. The point of direct democracy is to go around your legislature, particularly a legislature you disagree with. And the fact that it's become so difficult and so expensive undermines democracy at its most foundational level. I'm perfectly fine with the Republicans using these tools. The difference is, because of the Republican majority in the legislature, they've used the referral, not the initiative. And so you don't have to gather signatures. You get to skip the expensive part. You get to skip the part that you're challenged. And you get right to the end result, which is putting something in front of voters that they may or may not be aware what it does.
All right. That is Stacey Pearson with Lumen Strategies joining us to talk more about initiatives. Stacey, thanks so much. As always, appreciate it.
Thank you.
As part of our Last Resort series, we thought it would be fun to see what architectural elements from Phoenix's iconic resort past still exist.
From all over the world come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix.
a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
Today's hidden gem is the Casablanca Inn. The property began as the winter home of the Kellogg family before its eventual transformation into a Moroccan-themed resort complete with an onion-domed restaurant, the Sultan's Table. The show's Sativa Peterson met up with Scott Jarson, a longtime realtor in town who specializes in architecturally unique properties. The two walked around the former grounds of the Casablanca Inn.
This is just such a special property because there's so much history here. It was originally built in the 1920s. The architect was R.T. Evans. He did a lot of really fabulous adobe homes in and around the area. What you're seeing here with the Camelback Mountain backdrop is the original house for the Kellogg family that was built in the 1920s. And it was shaped sort of in an embrace around this courtyard, which is now the beautiful Rose Garden. So if you think oasis in the desert, we're in this beautiful green space. Tons of roses surrounded by citrus trees and a real resort feel. So they lived a really gracious winter getaway life here, like a lot of others who came from the Midwest for health and just get away from the snow and to kind of reset their lives. In the 1940s, this property sold to Borg Warner Corporation, and the Borg family used it as a winter getaway, also corporate retreat. They put in a private airfield, if you can imagine people flying in here, and what kind of desert hijinks they might get up to. But the Borgs were really good caretakers. They were the first ones to introduce this Moroccan theme. Interestingly, they bought it in the 40s, so maybe the Casablanca movie had a little something to do with it, but they're the ones that named it Casablanca, and they built this dome structure, which you see with this onion dome that just looks so sort of Moroccan-influenced, and that segued into the resort history. After the Borgs had it and it sold into a corporation that ran it as a resort, a lot of things that the Borgs did got incorporated into the more resort lifestyle that you'll find here. This pool, which we're going to look at, has something that was seen a lot in these desert resorts. You can see this sort of glass screen that we're looking at here. This was a windbreak that would surround the pool in those days. They were very, very common to see them. And I think they really just kept really, frankly, dust storms and desert winds from disturbing people as they sat by the pool, kept the noise down for the guests. And what I love about it is that in this exact location, there's several really great print ads from the 1950s that show models in great sort of Arizona dresses right at this very location. So the history's everywhere you see here. It's a really genuine property still. It has rich architecture from R.T. Evans. The original structure's really celebrated and not demolished. And even as it developed in the future, they brought in a really world-class architect. And I think that it just shows there's integrity in all these structures. This is how you would enter it as a resort. That was your lobby and check-in. And right adjacent, there's this rectangular building, castellated on top. Looks like it just came out of Morocco, with this beautiful, stunning white onion dome on top that centered right over what was called the Sultan's Table restaurant. And it was an event to go to this place. I can remember going with my family several times, and it always felt like you were taking a journey someplace else just to go have dinner. It was really fun. It was so romantic and so interesting because if you imagine through the eyes of a 8, 9, 10-year-old, you're being able to be brought to another world. You're also able to connect with a piece of Arizona that, and see it through the eyes of people who visit here, which I think was really important. But the signature romance of these places, they all had their individual character. And so to be able to come to the Sultan's Table to have a family dinner on a Sunday just almost meant like a mini vacation. And especially as these resorts started to stay open in the summer, most of them closed when the heat came on. But as a local, you could get those shoulder months and come in here, no crowds, complete service. It was a lot of fun.
That was Scott Jarson, realtor and founder of the real estate firm Jarson & Jarson. The Casablanca Inn still stands today. In the 1980s, it was converted into a collection of private residences built on the site by architect George Christensen.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The 1997 stage adaptation of The Diary of Anne Frank offers a glimpse into the lives of eight people hiding from the Nazis in an attic in Amsterdam. A local production of the play by the Bridge Initiative and Child's Play is running through the end of this week at the Herberger Theater Center in downtown Phoenix. Two teenage actors are cast alongside longtime Valley actors, including Child's Play resident artists Deborah K. Stevens and John Gentry.
What do you have to write about that's so important all the time? How much can a 13-year-old have to say?
Just because someone is young doesn't mean they have nothing to say, Mr. Von Don.
Please, can't I have any privacy?
Well, I just hope she's not writing anything about me in that private diary of hers.
Or me.
As the group hiding in the attic tries to make the best of their situation, two Nazi officers stand upstage, periodically crossing in front of the attic set and weaving through the audience with flashlights. In the original script, the officers only show up at the end when the Franks, the Von Dons, and Mr. Dussel are caught.
That was actually a directorial decision to create the feeling that they are getting closer and closer and are always there.
KJZZ contributor Robert Palo sat down with the play's director, Jody Weiss.
Jody, I have to say that the thing I'm most interested in is apparently there is an Arizona mandate about teaching kids about the Holocaust.
There is. There's, I believe, between the 7th and 8th grade, there's a mandate that they have kind of a section on the Holocaust specifically. And then sometime between grades 9 and 12, they need to learn about, as well, another genocide. So I think between 7th and 12th grade, they have to have two sections on genocide, one specifically the Holocaust.
So not both of them. About the Holocaust.
Correct.
You've cast teenaged actors alongside some of the Valley's best known professionals.
It was always my joke that all I had to do was sit back and say, you know, a little to the left, because these actors are truly top-notch talents here in the Valley, and we are very lucky to be working with them. Alongside them are Ariella Centeno and Spencer Waring, both young artists who have done the production three times now. They came over with the original cast that the Jewish Ensemble Theater did it the first time here in Arizona. They had been doing the production, I believe, Chicago, or they were based there. And they were cast then. I think Ariella at the time was only 15. She's now 18. And again, I'm so lucky. She has grown so much as an actress, even from the last time we did it.
So what are young adults and teenagers taking away from seeing this story enacted on the stage?
Well, we certainly hope that they are paying attention. And of course, we want that adage, never again, to stick with them. As a matter of fact, Child's Play is known for our, what we call our talkbacks after the show, to further the learning of the production. And that is the final thought that we leave the entire audience with is, you know, we say never again. And that means for anyone, you know, no more genocides or destruction of ethnic groups or nations. And we want that to resonate with them above and beyond Jewish people, above and beyond the Holocaust.
There is a certain timeliness about this production.
Extremely.
Yeah.
Extremely.
And I understand that the producers wanted to hire a Jewish director to helm this production.
They did, which I think is very important. For me, it's a very important story for me to tell, and I am thrilled to be directing now at Child's Play. I've been an actor with the company. I started over 40 years ago, and then I also took over their events, and now to be directing with the company is amazing, and this show in particular. So I think it's important for the mere fact that we have grown up with the ideologies of never again, how can we prevent this? Every year we have a memorial about the Holocaust, and we try to represent it in various different ways. You know, I know synagogues all over the world represent it in different ways. We used to do things like count out 6 million grains of rice and have that in the lobby of the synagogue so that people can visually see that number 6 million, because there's been no other genocide that has wiped out that many human beings.
Jody, thank you for coming in to talk to us.
Sure.
That was KJZZ contributor Robert Pala talking to director Jody Weiss.
On a recent Friday morning, around 60 7th and 8th graders gathered at Herberger Theater to watch The Diary of Anne Frank. Afterward, there was a Q&A with the actors. One student wondered what it was like to act out such a heavy story. Here is D. Scott Withers, who plays Mr. Von Dahn.
As an actor, you have to put yourself in the shoes, just like you said. So that's probably the most difficult part emotionally, is imagining yourself going through the same situation, and also just realizing that this isn't over. You know, this kind of thing happens still today, is happening currently in our world.
The students also had an opportunity to speak with Dirk van Leenen, who was 5 years old when his family was taken to a concentration camp.
My father was arrested and tortured for 5 days, so bad that he was laying on a puddle of blood and messed up totally when my mother had to come to clean him up and to bring fresh clothes. And I remember seeing that, and I was crying all the time.
One student asked if Van Leenen could relate to the play.
Very much so, because a lot of scenes in it reminded me of my scenes in my life. The hunger, the being silent, the fighting among each other, and also the threat that the soldiers would come and find us.
You can see The Diary of Anne Frank at the Herberger Theater Center this Saturday at 2 p.m.
That'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Mark will be back with you again tomorrow morning with the Friday newscap and much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.